Thanks, Tom. Yeah, I'm a breach. I'm an alcoholic, and I'm really grateful for sobriety. And it was suggested that I could read something that I found inspirational, but I forgot all about it until I just a minute ago. So I just found something in my book that I've written down. It's from another fellowship, but I think it's totally relevant. It's grant me patience with the changes that take time. Appreciation of all that I have, tolerance of those with different struggles, and the strength to get up and try again one day at a time. And I love that I'm sober and that I'm learning, still learning, how to live one day at a time, despite being sober since 1987, the 1st of December. And I love being sober, and I love that I got a chance to live life again. And I say again, but I never knew how to live life. So a bit about my background. I grew up in England of Irish family, and I grew up in a council estate, and I don't remember life being as difficult as when we moved. So I was 11 when we moved, and we moved to a different side of town where it was private housing, and I didn't know anybody. And I remember finding that move really, really difficult. And when I look back on my childhood, of course, I wasn't aware of the things at the time, but at the time I was feeling like not good enough. And that was because of the messages I received that why aren't you more like so and so down the road, you know? So I remember in my young days kind of just wanting to be another person, really. I used to wish that I was this girl. Her name was actually Patricia Connell, and she was one of those girls who was kind of good at everything, and she was very popular with the other girls. And I just kept thinking, I just wish I was her. I just don't want to be me, you know. I felt awkward and too big and too shy and afraid. I didn't know it at the time, but full of fear, you know. I was afraid of the dark. I was afraid of going to sleep. I was afraid of the shadows. I was afraid of spiders, you know. So many things put that fear, that knot of fear in my stomach that I never had words on to say, but that you know, that I used to get stomach ache a lot and not want to go to school. And then, of course, when I was 11, we changed schools. So it meant leaving my primary school, which was mostly like Irish Catholic, and going to this Protestant secondary school where I really was like the fish out of water. And I didn't know hardly anybody there. All my friends had gone on to a different school. And I was just terrified. I remember looking back at that first year, and I was filled with terror. I used to be so afraid to put my hand up if I knew the answer to a question. I was so afraid. I wanted to hide and fade into the corner. And of course, the strong will pick out the weak. And so the teacher that was the most bullying, she used to pick me out for that first year. And by the end of the year, something must have happened because I told my mother eventually. And my mother went to the school, and that teacher stopped picking on me. And by the end of the year, I found a friend. I still know this woman today, so many years later. And eventually, when I found this friend and a few more friends, I was like bucking the system, and it felt like, I don't want this. I don't want this uniform. I don't want these regulations. I don't want to learn this history about what happened 200 years ago. And so it was kind of my rebellious streak came up because it was like, I can't fit in. I can't be the best. So I don't really want to be part of, you know. And I flunked out of a lot of classes and a lot of subjects, and would refuse to learn point blank something that I just wouldn't see the point in learning. So you know, from a young age I had that very stubbornness, single-mindedness, and a bit of a fuck you attitude as well, you know. It was like, I don't want to live by those rules. I have no clue how I want to live, but I don't want to live with those rules. And then I discovered alcohol, and I was only a young teenager. I was probably 15. And I went out with a friend, and she got really drunk and sickened. She had long blonde hair, and she was all sickened to her blonde hair. And I remember thinking, this is terrible. This is awful. But the two of us, we used to go and drink, neck a bottle between us in public toilets, and then go out at night. And of course, I was just young, so it was just at weekends. And I used to have, from the very word go, it was blackouts for me, and couldn't remember what happened, what I did, what I said. And I used to try and laugh that off and think that that was really hilarious. But of course, like inside, I was feeling that feeling of shame. And, you know, why did that happen to me? How come my friend, she can remember what happened last night? So that was the beginning of it, you know, and I was no way was I going to try and give that up, but I was going to try and control it. So, you know, my ambition was, if I could only go out at the weekend and have enough drinks to get nicely and get that nice feeling where you're just a little bit tipsy and you're kind of a bit more relaxed and you're not as uptight and you're able to chat and dance and laugh with people. And of course, I never found that. And from a young age, you know, I got involved in relationships that were very unhealthy for me. And I didn't know, I didn't have, it's like I didn't have any boundaries or any rule book or any guidance, any advice. And anybody that did try and tell me anything, I didn't want to listen because it just didn't make sense to me. Nothing really made sense, you know, and I kept thinking, if I could get away from school, get away from family, get away from this town, I'll be okay somehow, you know. And so I left school at 16. I went working. My parents had a shop at the time. I worked in the shop, and but I just didn't get on with my mother, you know. And I was drinking, and so that was causing ructions really in the house because I'd come in with my knees cut open. I'd come in maybe vomiting in the sink, and my mother was very angry with me. My father probably was too, but he was a quiet man. And so, you know, I was really angry with her. I felt like she didn't love me. And I didn't feel, you know, that wanted and needed and accepted and part of. And so by the following year, I was on antidepressants, and I had saved up enough that I had decided that I was going to kill myself. And I took an overdose one night after I'd been drinking all day. And luckily, my father found me. I was brought to a hospital. My stomach was pumped. And my parents, they just didn't know how to deal with it. And so it was never mentioned. And that's how it was in our family. We didn't know how to deal with anything. And so we couldn't talk about anything. And there was no help. There was no like follow-up. I think a doctor did say, you won't do this again. And I said, no, I won't. And it did frighten me a bit, but by the age, yeah, a little bit older than when I was 17, and I ran away from home. My sister was living in London at the time, and I ran down to my sister's. It was over 100 miles away, and I got there. She wasn't there, and I had to go into a B&B, a sordid B&B for the night. And the next day, I got to her, and she said, "Oh, I thought you'd be coming. The police were here." And so she let me stay with her, and I stayed with her for about 6 months, and I got a job in a bar, would you believe? You know, that was where I was comfortable around alcohol. And it was very scary. I was very terrified, and I just didn't know what to do. You know, I'd left school, I'd left home, I'd left any job I had, and here I was trying to invent myself in London at the age of 17, going on 18. And my life just went on like that for years. It was like I was totally, totally lost and totally didn't know who I was. And it's like I just didn't have the rule book. I just didn't know. There was my sister. She was a nurse. She was settled down. She was married. She had a child. She was doing this regular work. And I was just looking around me thinking, what will I do? Where will I go? What can I do next? It was all about trying to reinvent myself because nothing seemed to be working. So for me, the next step was to go abroad. and to work in Sweden for a year as an au pair. And you know, when I got to Sweden, I remember thinking, oh my God, this is beautiful country and it's clean, and this is the answer, you know, and everybody here is eating loads of natural yogurt. And they gave me a bicycle to cycle around and put the little girl on the front of the bicycle. And I thought, I've made it, you know. And then 3 days later, the lady I was working for, a really nice couple, and she said, oh, there's another au pair down the road. And would you like to go meet her? And I went to meet her, and she took a bottle of drink out. And the next thing I knew was that I was vomiting in a nightclub out with a t-shirt all covered in it. And I didn't get home until the small hours. And I didn't know what happened. And they didn't know what happened to this young, beautiful girl that arrived to them a few days before. Here she was, a drunk. But I stayed with that family. It kind of terrified me. Drinking terrified me because I would never know what I would do, what I would say, where I'd end up, what would happen to me. And but I would not dream of giving it up. But it was like being on a tightrope, trying to not drink and not get plastered, you know. And I didn't get into that state again for some time. But of course, the job ended. It was a year contract, and I went back to England, and you know, I didn't know what to do, and I started doing part-time education. Just a friend who suggested it to me. And you know, and drinking regularly and thinking this is the only way that I can live. I don't know any other way to live. I couldn't imagine not drinking, because for me it was kind of like when I could breathe, it was when I could relax, it was when I could let go a bit, you know, of that fear and anxiety. And so yeah, I went back to education, doing part-time and working part-time and supporting myself. And eventually I went back and I did a degree. And I lived in London. I went back to London, and I lived with a relation and family. And I didn't know this lady. She was my mum's cousin. And she turned out, I feel like, that she saved my life, because she was just, I knew that she loved me, even though she didn't accept the way that I was carrying on some of the time. And she used to give out awful stink to me. She was trying to run a B&B for foreign students, and I'd come falling in the door. Bringing in all kinds of unsavory characters, and she would let rip at me naturally. But then she'd forgive me, and we'd get on with it again. And the two of us actually used to go out dancing together to the Galtee Moor in London. If anybody ever heard of the Galtee Moor, it was like where all the Irish in London used to go. And I had some great times with that lady. But when I think back to my head, it's like there was two people inside me, because one part of me was, I was happy, I was living with her, I was going to college, I was very uptight, I was drinking. And another part of my brain was suicidal. And a boy, a man, a young man I was going out with at the time, he committed suicide. He'd been in a psychiatric hospital for a while, and he came out and he put the pipe from the car into the exhaust, into the car, and he died that way. And I was quite obsessed with doing that for a while, but I felt that I couldn't do it to this relation that I was living with, because I knew she cared for me, and I knew she had an awful lot on her plate. She had a son with a disability, and she was widowed, and she was looking after him, and she thought a lot of me. I knew she thought a lot of me. And so I just couldn't do it. So I ended up getting through my college. I don't know how. I was afraid to drink in the day, because I knew if I started drinking in the day, I wouldn't know how to stop. So I used to usually try and limit myself to evenings of drinking, whenever that would be. I can't remember. It probably wasn't every night. I wasn't a daily top-up drinker. I was more like a bender drinker, you know. Hit it and then maybe recoil back from it, you know, and try and get over it physically as well as mentally, emotionally. So yeah, that I carried on like that for those 4 years when I was in London. And then when that all finished, I decided that it was time to move again, you know, on the move again. So it was a move to Ireland, and working in a hotel where it was it's a place called Listunvarna. It's actually not that far from where I work now. And they have a crazy month of matchmaking in the month of September. And that's when I went working in the hotel. And I just loved it because it was bedlam. It was mad, totally mad. There was like fellas coming in looking for their teeth the next day. It was that kind of place. And it was the police would come in and we'd close the barriers. And then the police would go out and the barriers would open and the bar would start working. I was working in the bar, of course, where I was comfortable and putting the glass up to the whatever I wanted when the back was turned, So, and then I went off to make my fortune with two other women from Limerick. And I ended up as a van driver in Dublin. I didn't even know the city, It was kind of one crazy after another. And part of that craziness, I loved it. Another part of me wanted it to stop, but I had no idea how it was going to stop. But anyway, only a few years later, I'm back to London again, looking for something, back again to Ireland another year later. And I was only in Ireland about, I was in Dublin about a year. And I thought, this is it. I've hit it now. It was like I was feeling more comfortable. I was, the pubs were open day round and I could get drink late at night and I had a boyfriend and we were getting on great. And then one day I said, I'm going to go to AA and just see if they can help me just cut down a bit. Because I still had the two people inside me. I had the person inside me that could I could be full of joy, drinking, laughing. And the next minute, I could be just crying uncontrollably with a terrible darkness that was inside me that I had no idea what it was. So, yeah, I was living in the South Circular Road and not far from where AA was the head office at that time. And I came across a woman who shared her experience, strength, and hope with me. And she said to me, you need never drink again a day at a time. She said, you'd be amazed at your life, she said. And she just shared her own. She wasn't really telling me you're an alcoholic or anything, but it was like the penny was dropping and the awful dawning realization that I was an alcoholic like this woman. But this woman had a solution and she was telling me that her life had changed. And I knew she knew what I had gone through. She was talking about coming in late at night, putting the frying pan on, setting the place on fire, or different things like that. Crazy, crazy stuff. And so I went to my first meeting that day on her guidance. I went to a place called Madonna House. And that was full of these massive religious statues, because it was obviously, it must have been owned by some part of the church. I thought, oh my God, I thought I'd gone away from all of this because I was brought up quite strong Catholic with my parents, going to Catholic school, my first school, and all of that. And when I saw the big religious, I thought, oh Jesus, no, not more of this now. Rules, regulations, telling me what to do, when to do it, all of that. But I got some kind of recognition and identification, as we call it, at meetings. That these other people, there weren't old men who sat on park benches with brown coats and string around them. They were ordinary people that couldn't control drink and that drank alcoholically, just like me, Even though I was only 29 years old, I felt everybody was ancient. But I had a chat with people at the end of the meeting and they were saying, no, they didn't, they weren't daily drinkers either. And that was kind of like, oh, all right. And this dawning. I was an alcoholic. I was 29 years old. The game was up, but there was a solution at the same time. And I got another meeting that day and I ended up ringing up my boyfriend and saying, I'm an alcoholic. I'm going to AA. And he said, what? An alcoholic. Sure, he was an alcoholic too. Who else would I be going out with? But anyway, other people in the family, even, when I rang them up and told them, I remember telling my brother, and he said, but you weren't that bad. But I had remembered him saying you undergo a complete personality change when you drink. And even my father said, oh, you weren't that bad. What does it take? Like a suicide attempt? Falling down drunk, not knowing who you are, where you are, but it's a disease of denial. And I didn't just pick that off the tree, My mother said to me, well, you didn't get it off our side of the family, so that was the shame of being an alcoholic, the lowest of the low. I heard from her as well, you know. So it was like I wasn't very delighted at being an alcoholic, even though I knew it in my heart and soul. It wasn't like nobody told me I was an alcoholic. They didn't have to tell me. I got the identification, and I got that mixed sense of relief. The game's over. And I give it another couple of tries for another few weeks. You know, I thought it might be different having wine in a glass at home instead of, you know, sitting up at a bar stool, but it wasn't any different. And it was only the members that really pointed that out to me, because I moved out to Bray at that stage after about a week or two coming to AA. And I was going to meetings there, and I confided in one of the members, and he said to me, "Well, you know, you end up right back where you were, don't you?" And I was like, "Oh God, no, I didn't know that. I thought I might be able to get away with a few." So anyway, that put the markers on that for me, and I came to the realization that I could never again drink safely. I could try and drink, sure, but I wouldn't know what I'd do, where I'd end up, or. And did I want to lose the days that I was building up? And I didn't, you know, and I was getting something from the meetings, because I was hearing people talk clearly and from the heart for the first time in my life. They weren't pretending anything, and they weren't telling me what to do. They were saying how they felt, you know, and that was total blown away by that. You know, I'd never heard that really. It was all, you know, trying to cover up and make up and put a face on and pretend. And now I was able to go into a room of people and not pretend. And most of the time I was crying an awful lot in my first few months or first year, I don't remember. But it was like the relief, you know, and the release of all these emotions that I tried to keep the lid on them and keep them down and not really tell anybody who I was, because they'd lock me up if they knew. And so I'd never gone for outside help. I'd never gone to a doctor or a psychiatrist or anything. I'd probably tried a million ways of trying to control it, but I'd never gone for help, you know. And in my early days in AA, it was suggested that I went to ACOA. So I went to ACOA in the there was a center there, the Hanley Center, just outside of Bray, and they did a course there. And it wasn't that my parents were alcoholics, because they weren't, but I identified with all the isms. So it was all the trying to keep the face up. You can't say how you feel. You can't, you know, you have to shut up and put up and, you know, and try and make the best of, and try and, you know, try and be achieving something and try and look good and all of that, that I wasn't achieving anything. So I was going the opposite road. I was kind of reacting to everything, you know, and saying, "Well, I can't be the top of the class, so I'm not going in the class at all," you know. So I ended up with all of that confusion. But and I used to hear that if you don't do a step four, you'll drink again. I was terrified of a certain, you know, after a certain period of time, terrified of drinking again. And eventually I did my first step four, and it was just full of resentment at the whole world. Not just this person, that person, the other. It was like institutions and politics and governments and, oh, you name it. And it was on my list. And then I don't know when I realized that I had a part in how I looked at the world, or how I looked at myself. And that's still, I feel that that's ongoing. I'll come to that, you know, just lately, of some other messages that I feel are in my brain that are quite unhealthy for me, that I still need to work on freeing myself from the past, from the messages that were given me, and from the messages that I took on and took to heart. And so, you know, that first fourth step, you know, was like, well, at least I'm giving it a go. I might not have an awful lot of awareness about myself and how I behave the way I behave and how I blame, because I was a total victim in my own life. It was like I blamed everybody for the way that I was. I just didn't know how to take that responsibility and say, well, I've been instrumental in those parts of my lives that have really hurt me. You know, I played a part in that, especially after the age of 18, you know. Until then, yeah, well, the parents have a big influence on you. So then, Yeah, so they told me, I used to love hearing the promises that I'll know a new freedom and a new happiness, because I didn't really know what that was. I knew how to be feel free with alcohol in me. I knew that feeling of release, but I didn't know that in sobriety. But I do remember, like, the very first time going set dancing and leaping around the place and thinking, wow, I can dance without alcohol. I can enjoy myself. I'm not, like, predestined to carry on drinking for the rest of my life. There is something here that is, there is a door that's opened for me, and it was AA. And since then, other doors have opened. So, like I say, I went to ACOA, and because I used to hear these big men coming into the AA meetings talking about their feelings, and that really got me, because I used to think it was just women that had all them feelings. I used to think, I wish I'd be a man, that they don't have them feelings. But I'd see these big men coming in and talking about, fear and hurt and childhoods, and it was like they could talk about all that stuff, and I got so much identification and so much freedom, because I grew up in a house where I heard this said, the neighbors were the most important people in the house. What do the neighbors think of us? So it's like you never talk about family outside of the house. That felt like you were, being disloyal. But I learned that I had to start talking about the things that happened to me when I was young and how I felt and how I coped with it, I grew up in a very codependent family. Our family was kind of enmeshed, If one person walked out the room, it's like, where are they gone? What are they doing? And then if you didn't go along with that enmeshment, it's like you were abandoned nearly. You didn't belong. You were either totally enmeshed, and I couldn't do the enmeshment. So I was like, and I thought I was free of it because I was away physically, but emotionally, I was carrying a load of baggage. I had an awful lot of guilt for leaving the family. And I left my older brother, he's 7 years older than me. He stayed behind, and he stayed behind and ran the business with my parents. And it was a very codependent, unhealthy relationship whereby I had the guilt. So I used to try and make it up to the family when I'd go back to them. So I heard in AA, it's funny how certain things really stick in your head, stick in my head. I heard a woman share, I'm doing the right things for the wrong reasons. So I was always bringing gifts back, and it was because I felt guilty. And it's like in just recent years, I've really become aware more and more. I suppose it happens so gradually, really, this growth in AA, of seeing myself for who I really am, and being able to slowly, very slowly change that, not to have to stay with the same prescription that I learned when I was young. So yeah, my sobriety has been full of changes. I mean, it's not like my drinking story, obviously, but in some ways it's very similar, because I've kind of still kept moving and changing and trying new things and new jobs and new courses, and at times, different relationships. I thought my life would go steady, and it'd be all sort of samey and calmy, and it didn't really go that way at all. And I'm grateful for where it is. I'm grateful for how it's been. I'm grateful for who I am. And at times I have to remind myself of that, because last weekend I was doing this pension application, and I had to list where I'd been and how long I'd been there and who I worked for. And it just looked like this one big crazy mess. And yet I was talking to a friend who stayed here last night, and she said, but you've got so much creativity, and you've brought so much to all those people that you've met. And so it's like I constantly need to hear a bit of positive, because left to my own devices, I'll start feeling that life was a shit show, really, and that I'd only just managed to survive it. I've done more than survive it. I've lived my life. And more, of course, more so since I've been sober. So after a year of sobriety, you know, I was offered a place to work on a craft course for 9 months. And yeah, with the help of support from one member in particular in the group who said, "This is AA, you know, dangling the carrot now for you to avail of an opportunity and do something." And you know, it was terrifying for me because it meant moving again, moving 100 miles or more, and going to another part of Ireland. And you know, I did that, and it was tough. It was difficult, you know, and I thought they were all doing it wrong in AA, because as soon as I went somewhere different and people were different, they were all doing it wrong. They weren't doing it the right way. But I stayed with it, and I got myself a really good sponsor, actually, and a really compassionate woman who was really, really good to me. She's passed away since in sobriety, but yeah, I'll never forget her. She was actually very religious. It used to drive me crazy sometimes. She'd be saying, "Hand it over to the man above." And I was thinking, there's no man above for me. But the love of the fellowship, and that she loved me and she wanted me to be sober, I could feel that more than her words. It was like her intention was for me to be sober. And she said, "Come on, we'll have a cup of tea and come back to the house, we'll have a cup of tea." And you know, just that connecting with somebody. I'd never connected with anybody in my life, because even though I was so crazy with my drinking, my alcohol, I had a complete wall up around myself, my wall of fear and keeping people out, you know. So that lady, yeah, we worked together through steps for quite a few years. And yeah, I finished my course and I discovered something I loved with art and with craft. And I started working in that area, and that's quite some years ago now. And I've kind of worked on it and developed it over the years. And yeah, my life was full of lots of changes. Yeah, I started going out with somebody who was drinking, trying to get them sober. So that was really good for my head. Not, you know, a full year of it. But I have to just say, you know, I was learning. And I wasn't listening to a lot of people, you know, of what they were saying. And eventually this woman, she gave it to me between the two eyes. She said, "You're hanging around with sick people, you know." And I thought, oh my God, I was furious with her, but she was dead right, you know, because I ended up wanting to drink again. You know, if I am hanging around with people that are drinking and going into pubs and I'm doing all of that, and I was trying all of that again. So yeah, that was Anne Murphy. She passed away in sobriety too. And I eventually, you know, it's like that letting go. How on earth do you let go? How do you let go and not know what your life's going to give you, or where you're going to end up, or what you're going to do in sobriety, you know? So it was like hanging on to anything that I could at times, and then feeling the pain of it, and then thinking, no, I've got to let go. I've got to let go a bit more and a bit more. And I can't plan it all. I can't plan how this is all going to happen. I have no idea, you know. And so I've stayed sober, you know, through all sorts of ups and downs and changes and moves. And my parents got elderly. Well, they moved back to Ireland, and they were still quite well-abled when they did. And so I got to have quite a few years with them. I actually ended up moving up to be near them, and got quite a few years with mum and dad, and that was great. I was able to take them for their appointments. It'd be like a big day out for us, you know, taking them to the chiropodist or something. We'd go out and we'd have tea, and you know, it was like repairing the past. It really was repairing the past. Finding a love and a tolerance and an acceptance on both sides. And they passed away in recent years, and I found that really, really hard. Yeah, but I know it's part of the natural cycle, isn't it? That your parents die and you bury them and you move on. And it was actually, as well as hard, it was like the proudest days of my life in sobriety, because it felt like I was there for them. And I was there for them, you know, in their latter years, and organized a lot of care and a lot of help for them, and was just able to show up as myself, not somebody else as myself, you know. So that has been some of my greatest joys. And then some of my hardest things has been in recent years since they died. I realized that, you know, I came to this realization about this relationship with my brother, which was really toxic and unhealthy, and that he exercised a lot of control. And because I gave it, because I'd lived with the fear and the guilt that he'd stayed behind and I'd gone and lived my life and enjoyed myself. And eventually then, you know, he didn't want us to sort out. I have my sister as well. To sort out the will or do anything about it. But through the help of AA and my sponsor, I found the courage to stand up to him and to say, no, I'm taking this on. I'm sorting this out. So it's taken a lot of sorting out, and he doesn't speak to me anymore since that. And he's really angry with me. And I can understand him too in some way. Because if I didn't have this way of living, design of living, I've heard it called, then I'd be really angry with anybody that, you know, messed with my boat or interfered with my power. You know, I'd hate them. And he probably hates me. And it's kind of hard in some ways. And yet I can't go back. And I can't go back to relationships that are unhealthy. So if there was to be a relationship, which may be one day, I don't know. I don't know the future. I'm quite open. But I know it would mean something like sitting down and being honest. And you know, and saying who I am and how I feel. And yeah, rather than pandering to somebody's whims. So I'm still doing an awful lot of growing up in AA, you know. I'm still really, I find it amazing at times. It's hard as well, because you feel like, Jesus, have I still really got them old ideas in my head? You know, the old ideas that told me I wasn't good enough and that I wasn't worthy. And, you know, I also go to CODA for my codependency, and I didn't go for quite some time, and I realized how easy it is for me to make other people my higher power. I did that with my mother in the early days when she came to visit me. I wasn't going to meetings, and I bumped into a member. He said, I haven't seen you at the meetings. I said, oh, no, my mom's visiting. She said, oh, is she your higher power now? So, yeah, I can easily just put people before everything, before my sobriety. And I need to stay focused, because my head can get wrecked, you know. So I feel that Codependence Anonymous, you know, the only requirement is to have healthy, loving relationships, something like that. And that was something that I never knew, you know. I never knew how to do that, and I am learning. I'm definitely learning, because I still can have the wall up. With the people closest to me, I can have the wall up, and I won't really say who I am, because I don't want to be that vulnerable. Because I did learn in my drinking that being vulnerable, you get taken advantage of, you know. And some of the hardest things in my sobriety was when I was 12 years sober. I discovered that I'd been raped in my drinking, not only once but twice. So it happened when I was 17 by my best friend's boyfriend. And it happened in my 20s when I was on holiday. And so I, on my sponsor's advice, I went to rape crisis counselling, and I got a lot of help at that time. And then it came back up again, because the walls came down within me again. So that came back up again for me in recent years. And I got another 2 years of counselling. And it's just been incredible and amazing and hard and worth it. So worth it to avail of every help that I can. AA is the doorway. It's the open door. And then it helps me to, you know, live a life. Look at those dark secrets. Look at those monsters in the cupboard and take them out and share about them, and and let them go as much as is possible. Obviously, they've affected my life, they've affected me. But I love that AA says, no experience is ever wasted. Because often when I've shared the really difficult stuff, I've got the feedback that, yeah, obviously I'm not the only one that went through that. And that there's a power in sharing. So when I was recently talking to someone and she said, "What's vulnerability?" And at first I said, "Well, it's people having power over you." And then I said, "No, vulnerability where I feel safe and I can tell my truth is actually powerful for me too." So that's what I've discovered. And so I work at music and art and dance, which is quite incredible. And yet some of my old ideas are there that it's not good enough, that I'm not good enough. And that, so I've just been talking about that with a friend today, and it's been amazing, and I'm going to try some affirmations to try and turn around my thinking, because obviously I have that old thinking inside in me, and it's very, very sneaky. It's not apparent. It's not like that it's my first thought in the morning or anything like that, but it's very, very deep inside me, And it's only through sharing, and when I come to be able to share with other people that I trust and that I feel safe and I feel comfortable with, then I can let, those dark secrets out that I don't even know are secrets. It's just like they're so drilled in inside in me in there, But yeah, so that's where I am. I'm so happy to be sober. I couldn't imagine drinking again. Oh my God, my worst nightmare to pick up a drink again and to think that it could do anything for me. I love that I'm part of this fellowship. I love that it's this thing greater than myself. It's this thing I can rely on that can rely on me. I'm part of a group. I show up. I'm responsible. I love to see newcomers coming in and saying that they're finding something that, that something is making sense for them. That really gives me life. It's amazing how it works. And yeah, I love my life. I recently moved to Kinvara in the west of Ireland, and it's the most beautiful place. Really is. It's gorgeous. You were nearly here. Well, you were here, Tommy, yeah, recently. I didn't meet you, but that was a pity, but maybe next time. But yeah, and it just kind of all fell into place in some ways. Of course it didn't. It didn't just land out of the sky, but it kind of happened easily. I mean, it happened in lockdown. It happened. I was moving. I knew when my parents died, I'd be moving. I'm back to probably Clare, I thought. But in the meantime, circumstances changed in my life, and I ended up looking at Kinvara and, yeah, rekindling an old relationship and finding this place, this magical place where, last year I went swimming in the sea every day, middle of winter, into that sea and out again in a few minutes. And I haven't done it this year, but maybe this winter I'll do it again, because, it's just amazing the things that I love today. I have a garden. I dug a few spuds today. I pulled up the weeds. They drive me crazy, but I just try and, I look at what I have today as that little reading I read out at the beginning, for what I have, for a drunk, that I was a drunk, that I could have so easily died, I didn't have the spirit, the want to live so much of the time. It all felt like too much for me, just too much for me. And today I'm alive. I love being alive. I love being sober, and I love my life most of the time. And most of the time, I accept myself as I am, rather than I don't want to be anybody else today. Always wanted to be somebody else, but I'm still working on that journey to feel that I'm good enough. I'm good enough for my life and for the people around me today. So I'm really grateful to be here, and I look forward to hearing people share. And yeah, thank you all for listening to me. And I wish you all the best in sobriety.